This webcast is a service of SDPB. More information at sd.net.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set for argument is Appeal Number 30809 in State of South Dakota versus Aiden Bradshaw. Representing the state and arguing will be Sarah Thorne, and representing Mr. Bradshaw and arguing will be Betsy Doyle. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Ms. Thorne, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. So you could proceed, Ms. Thorne.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel. This case requires reversal and remand because the circuit court dismissed a felony-level criminal indictment for two reasons. First, because the state health lab took too long to return drug test results, and second, because the state did not offer the defendant a plea deal by a certain date. The backbone of the circuit court's ruling was 23-8, or SDCL 23-844-3, the latter portion of which states that a criminal indictment may be dismissed in bringing a defendant to trial for unnecessary delay. But SDCL 23A445.1, otherwise known as the 180-day rule, controls dismissals for delay, and it defines unnecessary delay as 180 days.
In terms of the hierarchy of sourcing legal authority, the speedy trial rule is, in fact, a rule. It is not a statute. It's promulgated by our court. So how is it that it would have preeminence over a statute that was otherwise enacted by the legislature, maybe even the territorial legislature if it goes back that far, but how is it that a court rule would have that sort of preeminence?
Because as soon as the Supreme Court rule became statute,
it didn't imply... But how did it become a statute? I think it's a rule that we've promulgated. I don't think it's a statute at all.
It is a Supreme Court rule, and it was born of this court, as I stated in my brief. But when a Supreme Court rule becomes statute, the rules of statutory interpretation, as this court recently said in implicated individual, the rules of statutory interpretation apply to that Supreme Court rule just as it would legislation.
How does it become a statute? How does it change from a rule enacted by our court to a statute?
Not entirely sure exactly what you're asking, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Well, is the 5.1 rule, as we sit here today, a rule that our court could, at its next rule hearing, freely amend, revise, change, repeal? Is it that kind of a rule? Or is it a statute now that only the legislature can do something with? And if so, how did it become a court rule to a statute?
Well, when considering this case, Your Honor, I think what we used to call the rule of in pari materia, or now, as Justice Kern often says, Supreme Court rules need to be reviewed in a way that is harmonious with other laws. And as I stated in my brief, what's of utmost importance here is these two statutes have the same object and purpose. And when two rules or statutes have the same object or purpose, we look to the both of them and harmonize them if possible. And when they have the same object or purpose, they must be read collectively and consistently before turning to other rules or statutes for guidance.
Well, assume for a minute Justice Salter's argument, which is statute supersedes what a court rule can do. So in other words, our rule can't come in and modify a statute or lessen a statute or impact a statute because that's created upstairs, not in this courtroom. So assume that that's the case. Then if that's the case and SDCL 23A-44-3 is preeminent to our court rule, how do we interpret that separately. In other words, what's the purpose of that rule? What's our reading of that rule? And it seems to be very broad in terms of allowing the court discretion to dismiss, you know, for late indictments, late trials, delays in trials, things like that. How do we apply that statute? Again, assuming that supersedes anything that we've done as a court rule in the 180-day speedy trial rule, and it sets separately on its own, how do we read that?
23-44-3 is absolutely broader, Your Honor, and that's why we looked to the 180-day rule for more clarification. If this court were to affirm the circuit court's decision, it would effectively render the 180-day rule meaningless. In all cases since the adoption of the 180-day rule, considering any delay between defendant's initial appearance and the conclusion of a case, even considering the first portion of 23-44-3, so the time period between the initial appearance and preliminary hearing, this court has consistently turned to the 180-day rule for that analysis.
So your argument really is that the last part of the statute, which is the 23-844-3 statute, is effectively abrogated by the 180-day rule, and it doesn't really exist.
No, Your Honor.
What is it, and what does it do?
If we were asking this court to abrogate 23-44-3 or repeal by implication, that would mean that 23-44-3 must be clearly ambiguous or could be interpreted in more than two ways by a reasonable individual. I don't necessarily think that's the case here. I think it is broader and it is older. The 180-day rule is narrower and newer, and that's why we rely on that.
So why couldn't a court then – so the 23-844-3 rule is a real statute – excuse me, statute. That's a real statute. That still exists in your mind?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why couldn't a court rely upon it to, in a given case, dismiss an indictment on the basis of unnecessary delay without regard to the 180-day rule? The court just feels like this is unnecessary.
First of all, as I suggested, it would render the 180-day rule meaningless because that controls delays in bringing a defendant to trial. But secondly, it would revert our legal landscape 50, 60 years to a time when there were no bounds and no bases for the dismissal of a criminal indictment, unless the circuit court frankly thought so. 60 years ago, this court said, what is a reasonable speed in the disposition of a charge against an accused is a relative term and cannot be gauged in days, weeks, months, or other measures of time. What the state is arguing here today is that vague analysis is not necessary anymore because the 180-day rule eliminated all of that guesswork.
So the court has no choice. The court has to, in your view, the circuit court has to use the 180-day rule and cannot use an independent basis under 23-844-3.
That is the state's argument, yes, Your Honor.
And in that case, then that is a Supreme Court rule that has preeminence over a statute enacted by the state.
I think not necessarily preeminence, but it provides more clarity.
The statute bears a striking similarity to Rule 48B of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, which is really not utilized very much. When you look at the 44-3 statute, do you think it's a sanctioned statute?
I'm not sure what you mean. I'm sorry.
Well, let's say you've got the 180-day rule. It says what it says. You've got the Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial. We know what that is. This seems like option C. It doesn't seem like unnecessary delay under this statute is exactly the same as the speedy trial right under the Constitution. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that.
Because it says may, right? If it said shall, then we would know we have a speedy trial right. Because you can't violate the speedy trial right and have may dismiss or may not dismiss. It would have to be shall. So this seems like a sanctioned statute. And the reason I mentioned 48B is the comments and the advisory comments to 48B talk about a rule like this, similarly worded, as being sort of a capturing court's inherent authority to dismiss criminal cases for want of prosecution. Could that be a way to interpret 23A44-3?
I think, as I argued in my brief, this was our initial attempt at a speedy trial statute. And you're correct, Your Honor, that 23-44-3, the dismissal is without prejudice, and it is discretionary.
No. Could it be used as a sanctioned statute? Could it be used by a court to dismiss a case for want of prosecution? That's my question.
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because, once again, that would render dismissals on the basis of delay under the 180-day rule meaningless. It would mean that this court's supreme rule and our 180-day rule that we've relied on since its enactment would be purposeless.
So there is no option C. There's only the 180-day rule, and there's the Sixth Amendment.
When it pertains to dismissal for timeliness in bringing a defendant to trial, yes.
That's what we're talking about.
Even if this court were to disagree and to find that now, for the first time since 1985, 23-44-3 can serve as a standalone, valid legal basis for dismissal of a criminal indictment based on timeliness, with completely irrespective of and without consideration of the 180-day rule. The state argues that, as with other forms of dismissal, then Bradshaw would need to at least show prejudice on one hand, and then also some bad faith or intentional act by the state in order to gain some tactical advantage.
So are you implying then that unnecessary delay should be defined as conduct involving bad faith or intentionality?
If it were a standalone basis, then a requirement should be that there's some bad faith intentional act on the part of the state.
So isn't your argument really then that it is a sanctioned statute? I mean, that's why courts sanction parties, is usually because they act in bad faith or they're engaging in some sort of conduct that's not appropriate within the proceedings of the court. So isn't that really your argument, that it is a sanctioned statute?
My argument is that it cannot be a standalone basis for dismissal, Your Honor.
So go ahead, please.
So then why does it exist? Why does 23A44-3 exist?
That's a great question, but it's also extremely common. I mean, there are only 8 states in the country that have 180-day
rules. Well, it doesn't matter how many states have them. We have it. Legislatures told us that a court may dismiss in very broad instances, including delay of trial. And we've got the statute. And so we've got to do something with it. We can't just say it doesn't exist.
So it's not abrogated. I mean, that's what you've expressed. It's not abrogated. And it has multiple components, including, as the Chief just said, it can be used if there's a long delay prior to bringing an indictment or an information or a complaint. It could be used in that circumstance to dismiss. And so are you saying that it should be defined, read with the 180-day rule, so that necessary delay would only be a violation of the 180-day rule? Or are you saying that there should be a component of bad faith or intentionality to define unreasonable delay? I mean, we have to examine both the statute and the rule together. And so I guess the real question is, what is the state's path for reversal? Can you lay it out?
Yes. I'm so sorry if I haven't clarified yet. the state's position is that both can be read harmoniously because 44.3 is broad and general. 5.1 is narrower and defines what exactly unnecessary delay means, including all the exclusions there too. So the primary argument is that an unnecessary delay under 23-44-3 cannot exist outside of a delay under the 180-day rule.
Then we just got rid of the statute. If that's right, if we accept that argument, then we just threw the statute away.
I think it's fairly common, Your Honor, that statutes are read consistently and collectively, especially when they have the same object.
No, but if you're saying the only way this applies is within the context, it can't apply outside of the 180-day rule. If you're saying that, we don't need the statute.
I see what you're saying. I'm sorry. As a standalone basis
right.
to rely on. That's correct.
And we're just marginalizing it and kind of doing away with it.
That is the state's primary argument, that it cannot be a standalone basis for dismissal.
What is the harm to the state if the dismissal is without prejudice?
You all have a better gauge on this than I would, as I've never sat on the bench, but I cannot imagine that for the sake of judicial economy, that it would be ideal for criminal indictments to be dismissed for delay on a reason outside of the 180-day rule, for example, a case like this. The drug test results took too long, dismissed, and then the case gets reindicted and a new case is opened and for some other basis perhaps gets dismissed and reindicted. I think it is of utmost importance that rules be considered consistently across the board, and I think that's the beauty of the 180-day rule. We have very clear guidelines within that rule for courts to operate under. And I think in this case, the circuit court completely disregarded that basis for timeliness. And then, yes, Justice Curran, getting back to your question, I'm so sorry, but I think in the alternative, if this court were to disagree with the state and say, no, 23443 supersedes the 180-day rule and it can serve as a standalone basis, there was no prejudice here. There's no bad faith intentional act. The state sent the drug tests off, or the drugs off, 3 days after the arrest, 2 days after the initial appearance, and was simply waiting for those. I do have a couple other points that I'll address in rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Doyle, you can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Betsy Doyle from the Minnehaha County Public Defender's Office. We're asking this court to affirm the circuit court's dismissal without prejudice. South Dakota law is clear. If there is an unnecessary delay in bringing a defendant to trial, a court may dismiss the indictment without prejudice. This dismissal does not bar another prosecution on the same offense. The circuit court made clear in this case that this dismissal was not based on a 180-day violation. This dismissal was based pursuant to SDCL 23A443.
And do you agree with that? Do you agree with that implication that the 180-day rule and the statute at 23A443 are separate, indeed, sources that a court may use to dismiss an indictment?
Yes.
They are not merged into one. One didn't take the other one over.
Correct. This was not dismissed based on a constitutional speedy trial grounds. The analysis for the two is simply not the same.
Even if the 23A443 is a separate basis and it prohibits, in instances where the court finds unnecessary delay, it's authorized, doesn't have to, but it's authorized to dismiss the case without prejudice. Seems like a discretionary call. Yes? No?
Yes.
Yeah. And it is under Rule 48B, too. But doesn't the court have to have a factual basis at some point, or a record upon which it can say, you know what, I'm drawing upon the record here, I'm drawing upon this, and these all combine to form the conclusion that we have unnecessary delay here. Here the court sort of said, in the six-page transcript, said it's too darn long. But what about that? I mean, maybe there was a legitimate reason for the testing results to have taken so long, and maybe this wasn't an instance where factually the state failed to prosecute. So it seems like we got to the end real fast, and maybe wouldn't there have to be some facts?
Thank you, Justice. I would clarify that the circuit court in this matter found specifically that a seven-month delay in getting testing results was unnecessary.
But usually you would have to sort of say, this is why. Maybe there's a perfectly legitimate reason outside of the state's control.
And at the plea hearing on the record, the state had indicated that they were asking for a reset to try and expedite that testing. They offered no other reasons. They offered no other explanation as to why it took that long. This was also coupled with the notion that there had been three motions for delay due to not receiving an offer. I believe one can presume that the offer was not sent because testing was not received. Therefore, the state was put on notice back on their discovery and plea offer deadline, which would have occurred initially on April 5th of 2024, that they needed these results. They indicated at the plea hearing that they could try to expedite it at that time. That trying of expediting that testing results should have occurred months prior.
So you started to say that the analysis under the 180-day rule and under the 43 statute are different.
Yes.
Tell me, So we know what the analysis is on 180-day rule because it's set out in the rule. What's the analysis that the court should undertake when applying the standalone statute?
The analysis that the court would take is defining what would be unnecessary. Unnecessary is not defined. When we look to other statutes the state cited in their brief, they referenced the unnecessary delay in bringing a person arrested before a magistrate court for reading of a complaint. In all of those cases, though, they did find that it was unnecessary. I believe that unnecessary, there is discretion for the circuit court to define that as long as there are facts that are supporting that.
Do you think there's a bad faith? Do you think there's a bad faith element in there?
I do not.
So you wouldn't include that in a definition? You wouldn't include bad faith or intentionality in the definition of unreasonable delay?
I would not. I believe that the bad faith analysis in an unreasonable or unnecessary delay comes into play when we're talking about the remedy. In these cases that were cited, in all cases that deal with unnecessary delay, unreasonable delay in bringing a person arrested before a magistrate, in bringing a person that has been indicted or had an information filed to a court or to trial, when we get into the bad faith due diligence analysis, we're talking about the remedy, and that remedy would be a dismissal without prejudice.
Do you think that the length of the delay and the reason for the delay are things the court should take into consideration under that rule?
I would say not. Unnecessary for pursuant to this statute, it's made clear. I believe that the purpose of this statute is docket congestion.
So we don't have, I don't think we have that in this case. Maybe I didn't see it. But you're saying, so the statute isn't, let's say that there's a habitual issue with getting these test results back over and over again, case after case after case. Statute doesn't apply in that instance. Court finally says, you know what, this has happened 10 cases in a row. I'm dismissing this one.
Dismissal with or without prejudice,
Justice? Without prejudice.
Without prejudice. I don't believe that there, I guess, is an analysis of the bad faith. I believe that the premise for this statute is docket congestion and giving circuit courts discretion.
Counsel, you know, it was concerning to me that the court concluded that the delay interferes with the effective and efficient prosecution of drug offenders. Is that the court's role?
I believe a court's role would be to control their own docket. The reason for this dismissal was clearly defined as a 7-month delay in testing, and that was the sole result. This court made mention of other circumstances that were pertaining to this case in particular, pertaining to this defendant, pertaining to the state, pertaining to the circuit, whether or not the circuit is prosecuting these offenses compared to other circuits. However, the
Is
that relevant?
The reason for the delay, though, was made clear, and that was due to the unnecessary delay of getting these testing results and the state being unable to proceed to trial or to provide a factual basis.
So is this really strict liability? The state indicts a case, and whether they have a legitimate basis, whether they're in any way at fault, dilatory in any way, shape, or form, if it reaches a certain point, we don't know when that is, it's just too long, and it's gone. Strict liability, just purely by the passage of time, with absolutely no inquiry into the reasons, the whys, the wherefores, the justifications, anything like that. It's just too long.
I think it's left to the discretion of the circuit court.
But we have to review that discretion, and that's a very deferential standard of review. I'll grant you that, of course. And we accord judges the ability to make those decisions within a range of permissible choices, as our cases indicate. So understood there. But still, there has to be some, it would seem like, basis to conclude that it is indeed too long, that they did indeed not bring this forward. The civil rule is with reasonable promptitude. I'm not going to apply that here. But, I mean, they were dilatory. They didn't move this.
And in this case, the circuit court did not abuse its discretion in stating that a 7-month delay after 3 delays in not receiving an offer and abiding by scheduling orders was unnecessary to say that this case should be dismissed without prejudice.
Even though it's...
There was an offer, though, and a plea agreement reached
here.
And then it seemed like the circuit court then weighed in and assumed that something else was needed to go forward with the plea?
I believe that
agreement?
Something else was needed. In order to provide a factual basis, the foundation for any plea hearing is a sufficient, supported factual basis that is subjective. The state knew that it needed the testing in order to proceed with a change of plea hearing, hence why they informed the court at the onset we would need a delay because we cannot proceed today, meaning we cannot provide a factual basis or support it. I acknowledge that a defendant can make admissions. However, pertaining to this particular case, this particular substance, Delta 9 tetrahydrocannabinol, a factual basis could only be supported by those testing results.
Go ahead, please.
A defendant could admit and say, I knowingly possessed this substance. However, the specific chemical compound that can only be shown by these testing results is the difference between a misdemeanor or a non-crime or a felony.
Are we even in the realm? Go ahead, please. I'm sorry.
So then if that is the case, why was the delay unnecessary?
Because it had been pending since January. So it's 7 months of a delay where they don't have testing. The state then shows up at the change of plea hearing when the defendant and family, the court, had time on their docket, and everyone was ready to proceed, and the state then just said, we will try now to expedite it.
Was there a trial date set under the order?
Yes.
So my question, the reason why I asked that question is, does 23A443 even apply to this situation? 23A443 says that the court may dismiss in instances where there's been unnecessary delay in bringing a defendant to trial. There's no finding or determination that there was an unreasonable determination, or maybe those words were said, but I mean, this was never teed up for trial. This was a change of plea hearing. Are we even operating within the realm of this statute? Because this was not trial. This was, an unsuccessful effort to go ahead and have a change of plea hearing, but it wasn't trial. So that's what the statute talks about, and this seems like it wasn't that.
Trial was initially scheduled for June 17th, 2024, on June 18th. Defendant's counsel had informed the court they had not received an offer. That was after they had requested a delay due to not receiving an offer. So trial was initially scheduled June 17th. It was then scheduled for July 15th, August 12th, and September 9th. So yes, we are operating under this statute still.
The reason why it's important, I think, is because, again, the notes and some of the cases that are cited in the notes under Rule 48B, really, they're trying to pull together sort of this tripartite system that exists in the federal system, and it may exist here too. They've got a speedy trial statute. They've got a Rule 48B, and then, of course, the Sixth Amendment. They have all three. And in 48B and in the notes, some of those cases say things like, well, you know, this rule isn't intended to give courts general supervision rights or cognizance over how prosecutors move their cases along. And that seems important because when we have cases that are indicted, for instance, that's an indictment rendered by an extrajudicial body independent of anybody in this system. That grand jury operates on its own. And prosecutors have a great deal of discretion within the bounds of those rules about how they move their cases. Even when it's a dismissal without prejudice, is the court getting too close to supervising the details of how prosecutors bring their cases?
I would go back to, I believe, that the purpose of this statute and how it was used effectively here was for docket control, docket congestion. It's long been problematic in our
court didn't state. Say that, though, did they? Court didn't say it was docket controlled. Court didn't say this is clogging up my docket.
That's correct. The court said 7 months for receiving testing in this case is unnecessary.
Seems like a sanction more than I need it off my docket because it's overwhelming me and these cases are really too much.
Well, if the court would consider the time that was already incurred on this case for having multiple deadlines that were arrived and then not met and delayed, and then reschedule a change of plea hearing. At some point, this court can say, you don't have testing, we're here today. I believe that this statute is meant to say, come back when you're ready. It's a dismissal without prejudice. They can file charges when they're ready and prepared to proceed to trial or a change of plea hearing.
So it's docket control and a sanction, or docket control but not a sanction statute?
I guess I don't know if I have an opinion as far as if it's a sanction or not. I think I don't believe that this would actually be a sanction as far as punitive, because the state can come back and refile the charges when they have their evidence and they're prepared to proceed.
So does your view of 23A44-3 undermine the predictability of our current 180-day rule and its utilization? I mean, we have a whole defined body of jurisprudence now interpreting all of the various exceptions to the 180-day rule, et cetera. Doesn't your view undermine the predictability of the 180-day rule?
I would say that it does not undermine it. They are two separate analysis. They are two separate avenues, two separate inquiries, and most importantly, two separate requirements, shall and may. One is discretionary for courts to use, and it's a tool that is in their pocket that they can use when they deem necessary and can use their discretion to do so. The other is required, that it shall be dismissed. But most importantly, I believe that it's important to point out that these are two incredibly different outcomes. A dismissal without prejudice is not a sanction. There is no punishment. There is no prejudice to the state to refile charges when they're ready. But what a court is saying is, please get this off of my docket. Come back when you're ready. Not saying that you can't do this, not saying that you can't prosecute, not discussing the merits of the case, saying you are not ready, come back when you're ready.
So when can the court say that? 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months? At what point in time can the court say, you know what, this case needs to be dismissed?
I don't think there's a set timeline. I think that as this court...
So what's it based on, then?
I'm sorry?
So what's it based on, other than you're saying docket congestion? That's, again, very broad.
I think that courts can use their discretion as far as saying when is enough time, based on the charges, based on the merits, or the circumstances surrounding the case. And in this case, this court did not abuse its discretion in dismissing.
May I have one question?
Go ahead.
In every other instance, in the other two instances, I should say, under the 180-day rule and under the Barco versus Wingo analysis that applies to constitutional speedy trial rights, in those two instances, there's always an inquiry by the court to determine the reason and the justification for delay, attributing maybe the delay to one party or the other. And that figures into the court's analysis, and it matters. So a defendant who's saying, my rights were violated under either the 180-day rule or under the Constitution, may not win if they're responsible for that. And the same thing is true in terms of the state. When the state has responsible for the delay, sometimes there's an inquiry, most of the time, into their justification. Was it legitimate? Was it not legitimate? Was it something that was offered in bad faith? This option, if it is an option C, and if this statute is its own freestanding thing, under your argument, doesn't involve any of that substantive inquiry. It's just it got too long, and the court calls it because it uses its discretion. That would seem to be an aberration in this tripartite sort of, you know, speedy trial area of the law. Why would we not look, and why would we not have trial courts look at the substance of why something is taking so long?
Well, I think in this case, again, this court did, and it said you don't have testing, and there was no explanation offered other than we will try now to expedite it, meaning they can expedite it. And it had now been 7 months in this situation where they did not expedite it, and they cannot have that. I don't think that there could be a clear cut and dry rule about exactly how long, but this court even said itself in its decision that, and I'm not saying all of these cases or that 7 months for all cases would be this situation, but for this case it is. It exercised its discretion, not creating a rule that 7 months blanket is too long or X amount of time is too long. The notion that multiple scheduling orders had not been abided by, they're scheduled for a change of plea hearing on this court's docket, precious time in Second Circuit, and the state shows up still without testing results and no explanation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Thorne, you can proceed with rebuttal.
So let's pick up where Ms. Doyle left off. Was there any explanation provided for the state for the reason for the delay? Offered? She said the state didn't offer any explanation for the reason for the delay. Is that true?
Oh, boy. The only thing on the record is the plea hearing, and at the outset of the plea hearing, Circuit Court began with, I'm being told there are no drug test results back yet. And then the fill-in deputy state's attorney said, that's correct, Your Honor. So I guess I'd like to request a delay. The full reason for that request, I think, is not within this record. But there was no other information that the state was aware of besides we sent this off for testing and we're still waiting.
Do you think that in the application of this particular rule that that ought to be something that the court ought to inquire into before dismissing a case?
I think there was much more that needed to be resolved before the circuit court, before this case were dismissed. And piggybacking on the comment that that the state could not have proceeded without those drug test results, as I suggested in my brief, I think that is incorrect. This court has stated that at its very simplest, a defendant can plead to the acts alleged at a plea hearing by simply reading the indictment. I've seen the full verbatim factual basis for this case, and unfortunately it was not put on the record here. But either way, if the circuit court were not satisfied with the factual basis for the plea, it had several options, none of which were dismissal of the case. It could have granted the state's request for delay, presuming that may have been under 2344.5.1c. It could have accepted a no contest plea at that time under 2387.14. It could have deferred acceptance of the plea under 2387.14. It could have accepted a not guilty plea and asked the parties to proceed.
That really
to trial.
Wasn't on the table, though, because the defense counsel, first of all, it seems like the state kind of acquiesced at the outset, like, yeah, we need a reset because we don't have the test. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and that could be right. Technically, you might be able to get a plea that's provident without testing results. But in any event, the state said, we need a reset. And then the other thing that happened was the defense counsel, after relating anecdotal experiences in other counties, said, you know, I want a dismissal. So really the ideas of going through with this plea hearing in some form or fashion from the perspective of either party doesn't seem like it was ever really an option.
Well, it's truly undisputed that Bradshaw requested delays three times because right in his request he stated, I want a plea offer. It's also undisputed that the court granted three corresponding orders granting those delays. It's also undisputed that both parties showed up that day with plans to proceed with the plea hearing.
But I don't think the court can, well, I guess what I'm saying is I don't think the court can make them have a plea hearing if both the state and the defense seem to not want to have a plea hearing.
Absolutely. That was my point. If the court were not satisfied with the factual basis and didn't want to proceed with that plea hearing, there were multiple other options.
Including setting it for trial.
Setting it for trial, rejecting the plea agreement, really any of the above. But I think based on the court's comments in the hearing, even in its final conclusion of law number 8, it said the state was not ready to prosecute this matter to conclusion. The circuit court clearly treated this plea hearing as if it were trial.
Right, and that's the disconnect with the text of 23A44.3. There was no determination. This was never going to be a trial. This is only ever going to be. So I suppose if you didn't proceed reasonably with, you know, reasonable necessity and bring him to a successful plea hearing, and if the statute said that, maybe it would be a better fit. Is that your argument?
Absolutely, if that were within the bounds of the statute, but we were not proceeding to trial this day. That really loops in the couple other points the state brought up in our brief. This court has been so succinctly clear that when a circuit court really inquires into the evidence at the dismissal of an indictment, a pretrial motion to dismiss, that dismissal cannot be based on the sufficiency of the state's evidence because obviously that raises factual questions and the state's burden is beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. Similarly, the circuit court could not have used the basis of dismissing the indictment for failure to offer a plea because, as I stated repeatedly, no defendant is entitled to a plea offer. So there were multiple options for the circuit court here, but dismissal was none of them. As this court just suggested to Ms. Doyle, there must be some clear basis to analyze the delays in bringing defendants to trial. This was not the morning of defendant's trial, though the circuit court did treat it as such. It dismissed the case at this plea hearing, after telling the state that it was not ready to proceed. To affirm the circuit court would skirt around not only this court's jurisprudence, but also the constitutional mandate that no defendant is entitled to a plea offer. We ask this court to reverse and remand. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted.